Good morning, sorry for the slight delay, and welcome along. The order of business is as per the agenda. Are there any declarations of interest? None. Okay, we have apologies from Councillor Russell and Councillor Bennett. Are there any other apologies? Okay. Now move on to item 4.1, meeting of the Performance Review Committee of the 26th of April. Are members happy these are the correct record? Are there any points anybody would like to raise? None? Okay, I take that as unanimous. We then have 4.2 minutes of the Special Performance Review meeting and 4.3 the afternoon meeting of the Special Performance Review of the 8th of June. Any comments, questions? I'd be happy that they're accurate. Okay, I'll take that as unanimous. Everybody's happy with that. We'll now move on to 5.1, the inspection of Mayfield Nursery School. The report by the director. Or I think Grace, is it you that's doing this one? Grace, over to you.
Thank you. This paper outlines the inspection which was conducted in Mayfield Nursery School prior to the summer. Education Scotland released the letter quite early on, dated the 28th of June 2016. I have to say it was an absolute pleasure for myself and Julie Fox, the school group manager, to sit through the feedback because it was an outstanding inspection. As part of the inspectorate, they had evaluated both meeting learning needs and improvement through self-evaluation as excellent, and the other three indicators as very good. Education Scotland found very important key strengths given where this nursery is based, and they found that there were confident, resilient children who thoroughly enjoyed their nursery experience, that there was a welcoming and inclusive ethos created by staff where children felt respected and encouraged to be the best that they could be. Children's progress in communication, early language and literacy, and that's important because Mayfield also houses the ICANN unit. Strong relationships and productive partnerships with external agencies, and highly effective leadership of the acting head teacher and commitment to self-evaluation. And I'm pleased to say that Lisa Barnes is now the permanent head teacher at Mayfield Nursery. In terms of areas for improvement, they really spoke about developing further and current arrangements, so it was really affirmative for the nursery in terms of their direction of travel. We're also pleased to find that the Care Commission, when they visited, they actually evaluated the nursery as excellent in every category, so in all four categories. So in conclusion, the HMI, of course, will be doing no further visits to Mayfield Nursery, but we were delighted to see that during the inspection, Education Scotland found examples of innovative practice, which Lisa Barnes, the head teacher, will now share nationally. So that's really important recognition for the hard work of the nursery itself. So the recommendations there are to basically note the content of the report, and we also wanted to congratulate the pupils, parents and staff connected not just with the findings of the report itself but also the innovative practice, and obviously we were referring this report to this committee too.
Thanks, Grace. Peter?
Yeah. Oh my goodness, what a wonderful report, congratulations. Was this visit unexpected or was it prepared?
So the Education Scotland normally give between 2 and 3 weeks notice of an inspection, and it was one of the last inspections using the old model.
Well, I would really like to say what a fantastically good report, and may many more come the same way.
Thanks, Chair. It's difficult to sort of say this without seeming patronising, but for an area of multiple deprivation like Mayfield to get a report like this is absolutely fantastic. And I sometimes think, as politicians sitting around here, there's only so much you can do, and that is to supply as good buildings as you can and things like that. But at the end of the day, it's the quality of the teaching and the leadership that really counts at the end of the day, and I think we should congratulate in particular the leaders and the staff of the school for this absolutely excellent report, and as I say, it's particularly welcome in the Mayfield area, and I echo what Peter says. You know, I hope we can repeat this across the other areas, in particular the other areas of multiple deprivation within our county. It's a great report.
Thank you. Any other members got any questions? I think you just echo that, Grace. It is. It's a fantastic report to have from HMIE. Three very goods, two excellents, and then when you flip the page, you actually find the Care Commission's been in as well. And you have four excellence, which I think is absolutely outstanding, and I really hope that we do recognise this, and I hope we genuinely pass on to the staff there just how appreciative folk are of the work that they're doing, and as Jim pointed out, in an area of multiple deprivation, I think it's an excellent report. Congratulations and well done.
Okay. Could we just confirm who's going to write to the people involved? Because it really is quite important that we don't overlook that.
Would that be coming for Grace, yourself or Mary, or would it be coming for Kenneth?
Yeah. We have a normal process where we would do that following Cabinet and this committee.
Thanks for that, Grace. Thank you. Now move on to AI 5.2, agency staff. John.
Thanks, Chair. At the June Council, when considering the Quarter 4 report on adult and social care, committee requested that I come forward with a report on agency staff. Committee will remember in June that I was covering for Kenneth. The tables on page 35 sets out the historic spend for each of the last three financial years, firstly by directorate, then by head of service. In section 3.3 of the report, I've provided, in conjunction with my colleague heads of service, commentary regarding the use of spend on agency staff by service. In paragraph 3.9, I've set out the commitment to reduce spend on agency workers, which is a key part of the Council's low pay proposals, which were ratified and approved at Council in June. The financial details are set out in section 4, indicating that overall agency staff costs are met from within existing council staffing budgets. Chair, committee sought this report in June, and you're invited to consider the information presented today. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Questions? Queries? Jim?
Hi, John. We did agree that an aim of reducing the spend on agency workers at a recent council meeting, but it's been an aim of the council for some time, particularly when we're trying to find slots for the people that we find a surplus elsewhere, and it's I find it quite concerning to see significant increases in some of the areas, and some of them just through other briefings I've got an awareness of some of the reasons in the adult social care, for instance, although it's something that concerns me, I understand it. There are a couple of areas though, commercial operations and to some extent in the finance and integrated service support, that I would like a bit more detail on. We're spending £192,000 up from £11,000 2 years ago in the commercial operations area. Waste services, fleet transport services, how are we in a situation where we're increasing agency spending in these areas in particular? And I'm not sure if you're able to answer the finance and integrated service support as well. Although it's come down very slightly, it's still a significant amount of expenditure. I do appreciate the property and facilities management, why we're spending in these areas, especially with the house building programme and the build programmes, where we're employing people that wouldn't pay us to actually employ directly. It would be more expensive. But could I have some more detail in these two particular areas, please?
Yep. In terms of commercial operations, the large spend, as you say, is within waste and fleet. We used agency staff prior to the introduction of food waste collections when we held back vacancies. There's also a delay in recruitment to vacancies, and there's also been occasions where we've engaged agency staff on short-term basis to cover services, and also, unfortunately, in waste, has been reported to this committee in the past, we have a significant level of absence. Therefore, we tend to, on occasion, go to agency. Within finance and integrated service support, there's been staff absence, there's been vacancy cover required, and there's also been workload peaks within, particularly business services, communications, digital services, human resources and procurement. Going forward, it's my intention to take this report into the OPE implementation group. I said in my introduction, part of the underlying principles of OPE was to move away from agency and reduce the spend, and it's my intention to go into the OPE implementation group and report regularly on the reduction in spend going forward.
Any other questions? Peter?
I'd like to look at item 4 and look at staff costs. Now, I make myself enormously unpopular with my colleagues in the administration, but if you look at this, we are facing enormous staff costs, and we cannot do anything about it, because in the end of the day, there is this policy of no redundancy. We are still, if you look at our total budget, staff costs represent more than half of our total budget, and I find it almost impossible to understand when we have to make such great savings that we cannot slaughter that holy cow.
Oh, John or Kenneth, want to comment on that?
I mean, Councillor De Vink is correct. It's a matter of council policy, and as long as it's a matter of council policy, it's a matter of council policy, and as long as it's a matter of council policy, then as officers of the council, we need to work within that. And I think that our members will recall from the update on the financial strategy that came to the June council, which indicated the scale of reductions in budget we anticipate over the next 4 years. It is inconceivable that these reductions will be achieved without some reduction in staffing levels. And as officers, we work within the policy set by the council, and that's what we will continue to do.
I respect that, and I really, you know, recognise what an impossible job you have got. But I think it's good when we have all this laid out in front of us that we have a chance to reflect. And I would like this meeting to pass on to the administration that it really is something that one has to reconsider.
I'm certainly, Peter, you're in the administration, so I'm sure you're probably better placed than us to pass that on. Provost?
Well, convener, this was a manifesto pledge, and we've carried out the manifesto pledge that we'll have no redundancy policy, and it probably makes refreshing news that a party actually carries out its manifesto and make sure that people in bad times that we knew were coming along with consecutive right-wing Tory governments at Westminster, that we had to protect our workers in Midlothian, and that's what we intend to carry on doing.
Andrew.
Thanks, Derek. Yeah. No, my colleague Joe's quite right. It was a manifesto commitment, and you know, we're quite happy to make sure that we fulfil that. I think it's right that large organisations offer security of employment to staff. That we're living in a society where there's less and less secure employment out there, unfortunately. But there's lots of research which shows that large organisations tend to lose approximately, on average, about 15% of their staff per year. So it's not as though, you know, people won't leave the organisation. People will leave for their own benefit when it suits them.
Ian.
Thank you, Chair. I think that all of these issues come together in a single issue of planning, if you like. There's no reason why we cannot live within the constraints we've set ourselves. I agree with the constraints within the council of having a living wage, of having a no compulsory redundancy policy. We need the flexibility of having agency workers. But because all those constraints are there, and we know that there are budget pressures building up, and we know to a large extent what they're going to be over the next 12 months, we need to plan well ahead. I'm a bit concerned at the fact that we've known about the pressures that have seen the figure of £10 million next year has got to be found, and yet nothing seems to be coming to councillors to let us know how that's being progressed. I have this fear that we're going to reach the decision on next year's budget so close to the next financial year that we're going to end up with a lot of staff potentially in switch because we've said that we can't afford them, or we might end up having to take on agency staff because we've got a skills mismatch, for example. I just don't feel as a councillor that I'm being given enough information on what's happening as regards the budget shortfall, which we've all been well aware of for something like a year now.
Yeah, well, I wholly agree with you. At this time, we didn't have a remit to go through this year in this paper solely on agency staff and where we're using it. I have expressed the same concern that you as to the timing for this, as I have to the Chief Executive. But however, we're here for this paper at the moment. We can see quite clearly in it that the agency staffing has gone up, and I would presume that would be in light of the fact that we have the no redundancy policy, because it's if you're taking staff on, it's then harder to get rid of them. I take Jim's point, it's quite a good point. As for example, in Gary Sherritt's area, we've been trying for years to drive down costs, but when you actually try to drive them down by taking agency staff out, it actually drives the costs up, because you're taking on architects that you've maybe got a 3-month period where you've maybe not got a site coming forward, and you've very little for them today. So it's actually for that side service, and to be quite glad, I think, for example, if you look at new buyers, I'm glad we retain outside companies in that on, because they were the guys that took the decisions on whether we put gas membranes in or no. So it gave us that level of protection. And I think we said at that time that this council wasn't a council, and neither were any of the councils that were house builders, so therefore we need to buy that expertise in. But I wholeheartedly agree with Jim. I can see no reason whatsoever, John, that we're using agency staff for to cover the introduction of food waste. You know, these are very much semi-skilled jobs. Now, this isn't something that's been challenging us for this year, last year and the last couple of years. We've been sort of challenging officers for the last 10 years, maybe 15 years. And indeed, I'm sure there's been a couple of times some 10, 12 years ago where we actually took a policy decision that only agency staff would only be used when it was absolutely impossible not to use them. Now, we talk about we have a no redundancy policy, but we have to work within that. Yet, we didn't seem to have to be working between that. And as I say, this isn't something that's coming up now. It's been coming up for, I've got to say, Russell, you've been here longer than me, but certainly since I've been a councillor since 1999, one of the ways of trying to drive costs out of this council was to stop using agency staff. So it is disappointing to see it back on the rise, and I didn't think it's anything we've ever got through to. Provost.
Well, my understanding is that in the food waste section there's a couple of drivers often long term sick, so the only way to cover them is by using agency staff. There's nothing else we can do about that.
They can employ other drivers on short periods of time without taking on agency staff. There are other drivers out there that are looking for fixed term contracts, etc. So it's areas that you could get them. It's just an area where I find, and I know it's in the big picture of things, it's quite a small spend, but it's an area where I think to myself that if you were applying the policy to try not to use agency staff, and keep in mind one of the things that comes along with agency staff is that they're quite often, they can just leave just as quick as they come in, so they're just not as reliable. However, I think if we're going to drive down costs, then we need to drive out stuff like agency staff and that. And if we are wanting to give a fair and equal playing field to all the staff that come and work for us, whether they're agency, temporary or whatever, that then the quicker we get into employing our own poorly staff across the board, that then the better. Peter, did you want back in?
Yeah, if I may. Agency staff is unfortunately the only way we can tackle the very severe economic environment that we are facing with, and we haven't really explored it sufficiently. If I look at the Borders and Glasgow Council, they both have completely taken their IT departments and replaced it by agency staff and have made an enormous saving. This is something we should look at into ourselves, and we should really explore further ways, because we are facing this absolute Armageddon amount of budget deficit in the very near future, as Ian pointed out.
On that point, though, I mean, every time councils get rid of their own staff and bring in another company to do it, the company's very good at undercutting. Then all of a sudden, within a few years, they're well, well above the cost it would have cost us to employ our own staff. And as for short-term contracts, they can be just as expensive as agency staff. There's nothing we can do about people going off in long-term sick. That's the unfortunate thing.
Jim?
Yeah, what Councillor Devine's describing isn't the taking on agency staff, it's privatisation of council services. So at this meeting we've heard him talking about privatising council services and talking about considering withdrawing from our no redundancy policy, which either of which would be totally unacceptable to me. I think, though, that maybe for the no redundancy policy perspective, it's maybe something we need to look at in terms of fine-tuning, because it seems to me that maybe we're not flexible enough within that. If we're in a situation where we're continually having to hire significant, take Derek in the bigger picture, it's maybe not a massive amount of money, but it's a significant amount of money for agency staff, then maybe there's something not quite right with the way we're operating our no redundancy policy in terms of getting people in, even on a temporary basis, to do some of these jobs that we're actually getting agency staff. I understand, I mean, if there's a couple of bucket motor drivers that are on long-term sick, then that's something that would be difficult because of the experience that they require, maybe to use people that are in switch or that are surplus in other areas. But you know, I think this may be something that we need to have a wee look at, and how flexible is that policy, and could be tweaked a wee bit to try to avoid the situation where there's agency staff being employed.
Yeah, I mean, I said in response to an earlier question, my plan is to take this report with the comments here into our low-pay working group so we can monitor going forward. And I think, as Councillor Batts says, there's a lot of things relating to workforce planning and workforce, and this is just one, but it brings it all together. So my plan is to work across all directorates and take it forward, because my preference is, without good reason, I would rather have directly employed staff working for the council rather than going to agencies or third-party contractors, unless it's specialist services.
Peter?
Yeah, could I defend myself? I am not trying to advocate the privatisation of council services. I am just a realist that is looking, staring this enormous deficit in the face. And for that reason, I feel we have to think out of the box, and we have to do things that we don't like. I, like John, would much prefer to have our own reliable employees. But if there is no other option, we just have to work in the realities of the world.
Okay. I think we've had a good kick at this, and I think we're quite clear enough that the last thing we want to be doing is using agency staff. And one of the ways to stop us having to use agency staff, and probably address the point, Jim, you and Joe have made, is that if we have two bin lorry drivers that are off in long-term sick, let's train enough of the guys that are not the drivers, let's get the personal development plans to the guys on the street, because that's what we talked about 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, 14 years ago, which have a squad of workers there, and make sure that it's not just the staff in the offices that have personal development plans. Let's make sure the guys that are cutting the grass, emptying the bins, sweeping the streets have personal development plans, and let's train them up. So as if you have two guys off in long-term sick, you've got another 10 guys there who can actually step up and earn a wee bit more money for that period of time while they're whilst they're off, because there's a huge difference between the guys emptying the bin and the guy who's actually driving the lorry. There's a huge difference in that pay, and somebody getting 2 or 3 months doing that job. That's how we worked when we worked in the pits and a lot of other areas where you were trained on different jobs, and it was when you were doing them you were getting paid. And Kenneth, you'll remember when we arrived here, we talked about getting, what was it, I keep calling it geriatric, generic working. And I think the more we get generic working, then the more benefit we get to the staff. Anyhow, I think if we had a good enough kick at this, and we're happy, and we're just reinforcing that message where possible, we would rather have directly employed staff, and we would ask officers to bear that in mind. Everybody okay with that? Okay, thank you. We now move on to item 5.3, 0 hours contracts and a living wage. John, is that you again?
Yes, thanks, Chair. This is the second report you requested at the June committee and relates to 0 hours and living wage. As at June, there was 55 employees were on 0 hours contracts, and the rationale for employing these staff is set out in section 3. The table on page 41 also details the areas where staff are on 0 hour contracts. Also in section 4.1 and 4.2, provided some background predominantly from the Living Wage Foundation regarding the living and national wage rates, and also in section 4.3 I've detailed the current and the proposed council pay rates for our lower grades, that's grades 1 through to 4. Committee asked for this report in June, and I'm inviting committee to consider the information set out. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, John. Any questions or comments? Ian.
Thank you, Chair. I've raised this issue before and asked about the zero-hour contracts, and to a large extent I've been satisfied with the answers. I think rather than looking at the raw data, the question I would like to ask is to address the issue which has come up nationally when zero-hour contracts have been debated, and that's the situation of people who are unemployed, the signing on, and they are told by the unemployment, by the job centre, that they cannot claim unemployment benefits because they cannot guarantee they'll be available for work. What I'd like to know is that are there any staff employed by this council who are in that position where they're caught between having to give a commitment to the council to say they're going to be available as opposed to being able to say to the job centre that they're going to be available, and therefore may be in a very difficult situation. I can see that for many people, particularly like the ski instructors perhaps, or adult learning classes, for example, that it's supply and demand, and they're probably quite happy with the arrangement. If that's the case, I'm happy with the arrangement. But really, are there any other situations which we should perhaps be concerned about?
I can't give you a definitive, but in preparing the report and working with colleague directors and heads of service, that situation you alluded to never arose, but I'll take an action just to double-check there's no any impact in terms of job centre implications.
I mean, the zero-hour contracts are much maligned, and we have an almost infinitesimal percentage of people employed if you exclude the snow sport. You know, we are talking about what is the total payroll of this council?
It's a good point. I mean, there's over 4,000 full-time equivalents employed by the council, and in reality about 6,000 people working for the council just now, so it is a very low percentage.
I mean, it really is no issue, and I am actually quite a fan of zero-hour contracts if one pays the people, then it compensates for all the things they don't get by being fully employed.
Brian?
Yeah, so even sports directors moving away from 0 hours contracts now, and to minimum kind of hours kind of contracts. And I didn't even know we had that many ski instructors. You know, never mind 34. I'm presuming they're all part time, and every ski instructor is on a part time requirement, and they'll come out as in when we dictate. But surely there must be a system where we could have a core minimum hours of ski instructors, because we can plan ahead. I mean, it is obviously a seasonal demand, an increase at times, but I mean, the dry slope's open all year round, and many school children are learning throughout the year or throughout the school year. And I think, you know, there must be ways where we can mitigate the 0 hours contracts, particularly in that scope.
John and Dickon, if you want to try and answer that.
I want to make a general point, if that's okay, Chair. In terms of the ski centre, its financial and operational performance is continually on the upslope, and it's continually improving compared to where we were. And I've also said in the report that the arrangements regarding 0 hours contracts are subject to an ongoing review by the ski centre manager. So it's something we're currently aware of and currently looking at. But overall, the ski centre, from where we were, the special council meetings, the chair will remember back in August 2012 or something, and working together, we've managed to put the thing in a better footing.
Yeah, I've got to say, I acknowledge that we've got a lot better, and I can quite remember back, I think it was 2010, 2011, when we actually looked at this and strongly and actually says quite categorically, if it didn't improve, we're shutting it. It was costing our £500,000 a year of a loss, and then losing another £500,000 on top of that. And I think a lot of the stuff put in there by Ogo and Andrew Goldburn and that has significantly worked, and I think it was the sort of the junt that the staff needed up there to get going. What I can quite clearly remember was the issue of the 0 hour contracts for the ski staff, and I think a lot of it was to do with the fact that a lot of ski staff wanted the freedom to be able to shift, because they were a lot better paid, shifting to, I'm going to say, to France, to the ski slopes in there at certain times of the year. So they wanted freed up to be able to shift about the system, and didn't want tied down to have hours. So there was a lot of different stuff involved in there, because at that time I think we managed to eradicate a lot of the staff that were in sport and leisure that were on these 0 hour contracts, and I think they were fitness instructors and stuff like that. They were all pulled out. But the ski slope centre, there was a problem with the way that the actual ski instructors wanted to be, because they were getting and could earn a heck of a lot more money moving to other places, so therefore they didn't want tied down to us to do that. Now, I don't know if that's positions changed or no, but I'm sure if we ask, we'll get a report. John, if you could maybe drop Brian Sahano for the rest of Sahano, just saying if there is any changes there. Brian?
Yeah, just on the numbers, you know, that are actually employed at the snow sports centre, and if 34 are actual the total number of ski instructors that are available to us at that centre, and follow on, is there any prepared to work throughout the year, you know, with us, or even work on seasonal temporary contracts as well? It would be interesting to know. There's things where you can get a seasonal boost to their wages with tourism and going abroad and stuff like that. But surely we could be flexible enough to allow employees to have that. We do that in other career lines, where we allow them to leave for a period of time and come back again. And the other implications with 0 hour contracts is in mortgage payments. You know, we've got to think, you know, when you're actually requiring a mortgage, you've got to state what your guaranteed hours are or guaranteed earnings are. So, you know, I'd like to investigate this a bit further, you know, because, you know, it did surprise me that we had that many ski instructors, You know, it wouldn't surprise me if it was ski centre staff was the total number, you know, on zero-hours contracts, but it does surprise me as the word instructors.
What I suggest, Chair, is include that aspect in the written response you've asked for this committee.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. And I think we're a facility that's open 7 days a week for the very start of the morning with school children going there for their primaries and that. It's a very physical, I'm not skiing myself, but I'm told it's really physical and you need to be fit. However, I'm sure, John, you'll come back to that. But I think we need to keep in mind the point that Peter made right at the start of this, that there's around 4,000 full-time equivalents, about 6,000 people, and we have a maximum... 55 people that are on 0 hours contracts. Ian?
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, just going back to the issue that Brian raised there about mortgages, etc. My understanding is that these, particularly the ski instructors, will be self-employed. And if that's the case, then the normal practice is for them to show a bank the last 3 years' accounts. And if it's proved to them that there seems to be a steady income coming in, I don't think there's a problem. I take it they are classed as self-employed.
Probably are classed as self-employed, but when they're working with the council, they're directly employed by the council. They're on council pay rates, council subject to council tax. And then I, yep. But a lot of them, coming back to the chair's point, are flexible. And they've got a lot of number of other interests. And it's not just a Midlothian Ski Centre issue. It's across the whole of the ski industry. I remember speaking to a boy when I was in Canada. And he basically done his skiing stuff in the winter. And he was driving glazier trucks to one of the big iconic things in the Rockies in the summer. So people were quite happy working with three or four jobs because they depended on their own circumstances, and it is a minuscule part of the council workforce.
Effectively, they're not any different for somebody that's got two part-time jobs. I mean, that, as far as applying for mortgages and things like that, I expect they would be able to do it that way, by showing their earnings for other sources over a period of time. They didn't have to be self-employed as such to be able to do that, I wouldn't have thought.
Ian, sorry.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, it's the water's getting a bit muddied here. I think we all want to know, are the ski instructors happy with the arrangement? Does it suit them? If it suits them, I think we'd be happy with it. If they are PAYE, do they have union representation, for example? Do they have somebody to speak on their behalf? I think we just need some sort of reassurance that they're happy with the arrangement.
Yeah. I didn't think they'll actually say they're happy with the arrangement. I think they would like the arrangement Brian just described, where they're free to leave us whenever they want, but we have to pay them whenever they're here. I would love a job like that too. In fact, I'd like two jobs like that. John, you'll send us an off-road briefing on that, but I didn't think that word happy will ever come into it, Ian. Okay. Any other questions for John on this issue? Okay. We're happy to note the report, and thank you for your attendance. We have a MAPA briefing for members who have put it in their diaries or that whatever. I think at 12:30. Is it 12? 12 o'clock.